Welcome to Wine and Dine. My name is Lynn Crelo Chamberlain, host. You're listening to iWine Radio. A couple of months ago, when we had the pleasure of talking to the owner cider maker of Foggy Ridge Cider, she introduced us to Jocelyn Kuzelka, who is a cider maker. She actually is the cider maker, the one who actually takes care of the cider making at Foggy Ridge Cider. And she consults with other wineries for winemaking and for cider making. Her business is Panacea Wine Consulting. And as of right now, this moment, she doesn't have a website because she spends all of her time working and consulting with people. So you're going to have to rely on our conversation here to learn more about her. She has two science degrees, one Bachelor in Science in Biochemistry and Chemistry from Virginia Tech, and a Master of Science in Enology from the University of Adelaide in South Australia, former Roseworthy University. She works with a lot of people, and we're going to learn about cider making and the clients she has and talk about trends that's going on right now. And she's joining us from her office in Patrick Springs, Virginia. Jocelyn, thank you so very much for joining us today. And I'm curious how you ever got on the track of cider to begin with. Did you have a love affair with cider when you were like a teenager or young adult before you even went to college? I would love to hear about how you got into this and your career.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's my pleasure to be talking with you today. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very flattered to be here speaking with you. And actually, it was in my early days of coming back to the States from abroad and trying to piece together, living in this very remote rural area of Virginia, trying to piece together several winemaking gigs. And during that time, I met Diane Flint from Foggy Ridge Cider, and she was just beginning. I had met her briefly, actually, before I left the States, and she was just beginning, I guess, her third year of production in 2008, and that's when I started consulting with her more on the, really in the seller side of the business, and working on blends and creating new products. And just looking at, you know, sort of the science and the art that comes in with blending that we do with the apples as well as the cider, but also taking more of a scientific view on really trying to figure out why things are occurring and just trying to get a better idea of how to make more proactive decisions. So from there, over the next 2 years, more cideries came on in Virginia, and at that time I met with a few of them and started, depending on the client's needs, exploring more cider, tasting more cider, and just working with various cider makers on their ideas and in their orchards and their kind of fruit, and just learning really with my hands in the cider about cider and just trying to get a feel for history and a scientific basis on research on cider and apples. And I've been really lucky to meet with plenty of people who have are just a font of knowledge about apple trees and growing apples and heirloom varieties. And so it's been quite a journey.
When you were in high school, obviously you must have been strong in the sciences and in chemistry. But when you were at Virginia Tech studying biochemistry and chemistry, I don't, was it organic or inorganic? Did you ever think that you would take this degree and learn and then go the direction of winemaking? Or how did that evolve?
Well, I grew up with my father was an immigrant from the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at the time, and my mom's side of the family is Hungarian and Slovak, and so I have a strong family history of fermentation, and whether it be making sauerkraut or sour pickles or picking berries on the side of the road to make some home wine or making beer with my dad. All of those sort of things were just things that I grew up doing as my whole life as a young child. And I really got into sort of history and science, and what I really loved about science when I was growing up that sort of made me decide to go into the science field was just figuring out why things were occurring and just constant discoveries. And, you know, learning about that was just, that really is sort of how my mind works. And I like to break things down and try to figure out, you know, why is this happening, and try to understand the systems that occur. So that's why I got into science. And it just so happened after I graduated, I really loved doing biochemistry. I thought I was going to go into proteomics and cancer research, but I took a harvest job as a cellar hand at a winery, and I loved it. And I got immersed into sort of the food and wine culture, as well as the hard work. And I was lucky enough to work with two scientists, or retired scientists, who really valued the chemical analysis and trying to understand that side of things, as well as just appreciating the lifestyle. And so that really opened my mind, and from there I really took a big turn and life path, and just decided that I wanted to learn about grapes and making wine, and I wanted to be a winemaker.
Why did you decide to go to South Australia instead of get a Master of Science degree in the United States?
Well, a lot of that just sort of comes from being young and in my early 20s and having a big wanderlust and a desire to explore cultures and flavors. And I really love, you know, sensory analysis and trying to figure out, you know, what chemically happened in this matrix to make me think that I'm tasting this flavor, and just understanding sort of culturally different flavors and where they come from. And so I just love to travel. And when I did my cost analysis of going to, say, UC Davis and living there for a few years, there were a few things money-wise that attracted me to going abroad, in that it was actually cheaper for me personally to live over there than to live in California. So that was a big plus. And then also just wanting to do it practically. I come from a long line of DIY, do-it-yourselfers, and I love to get my hands into something, and I don't want to just be based in theory. And so that was a big draw to me to the University of Adelaide, was that was a very practically based program, not just getting a master's degree and doing a research project. It really encompassed making lots of different styles, and exploring, you know, sparkling wine and distillation. And
okay.
So that's how I came to that.
Well, if you were exploring so many different styles, I would surely think that that gave you a basis for being able to change on a dime. I mean, if you're doing consulting work, everybody has a different dream. Everybody has a different philosophy. Everybody
so
has a different outcome that they want.
Yes. Yeah, and that's something that I really try to sort of tailor to people, to work with them and what their dreams are. I have a lot of people, you know, that say, well, wouldn't you want to have your own business? And, well, in some ways, yeah, I do see a lot of the positives to that. But what I really like is being able to understand what someone is trying to achieve and create, and trying to just help them, you know, learn tools and work with their specific products to make really what they want to like and what the market is responding to. And that's what I really like to work with is, you know, to see a growth in my clients' styles and defining what is their cider and what are their products. And that's really what I, you know, appeals to me in working with different clients.
As a obviously a lifetime learner, and that's a hat you wear as a learner, not as a student, because you absolutely, it's a motivation unto itself to learn, constantly be learning.
Yeah.
If you have your own brand, there's not that kind of intense critical thinking and problem solving as if you're working with several different people. And as you use the word matrix, several different rubrics of,
yeah,
of how to do the different products. So
yeah.
I think in part what I was particularly impressed with that I never thought, I didn't even think to myself that a cider could be, was Diane Flint's, the driest cider she offers. And I don't remember which one, what it's called.
The Serious Cider.
It was like a dry white wine.
Yeah.
My husband fell in love with it because he's a beer drinker. And he liked it better than beer. He's a he's a lager person.
Right.
And he liked it better than beer. And so I just thought, you know, other ciders that I've had, whether it's been France or California, they always have a good dollop of residual sugar.
Yeah.
And surely that is a choice for how they want their cider to be. But that serious cider was just an eye-opening for me.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so pleased to hear that you enjoyed that. That's one thing we've worked on really hard, to get that apple flavor and still be a dry cider. So I'm very pleased to hear that you enjoyed that, and your husband as well.
Oh, yeah. I've had Calvados before, and I liked this so much more. We're going to go to a short break here, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Jocelyn Kuzelka. She's a winemaker and a cider maker. Her business is Panacea Wine Consulting. And if she allows, we'll provide her email address to the segment description. We'll be right back. You're listening to Wine and Dine.
This is Diane Flint. I grow heirloom cider apples and make cider in the southern Appalachian Mountains of Virginia at Foggy Ridge Cider.
Thank you for listening to iWine Radio. I'm Lynn Crelo Chamberlain.
Welcome to Wine and Dine.
We're continuing to learn about cider making from Jocelyn Kuzelka, K-U-Z-E-L-K-A. She's based out of Patrick Springs, Virginia. And she has several clients, both winemaking and cider. And what introduced us to her was the ciders of Diane Flint at Foggy Ridge Cider, because Jocelyn is the cider maker. Jocelyn, are all of your clients on the East Coast or in Virginia, or do you travel elsewhere?
Well, I will say that much like the growing cider industry, my client base is growing. I am doing national consulting, but most of it is currently based in the Mid-Atlantic states and along the East Coast.
So when you begin with a client, I mean, do you have like a conference with them to try and figure out mutually whether, in fact, you can help them? I mean, have you ever had somebody ask you to consult and you knew that you didn't want to work with them or you could not help them?
Yes, and in some ways, some of that often comes down to, you know, I'm sort of a one-person band, and sometimes just the projects that come up can be really involved, and I just don't have the time for that. But generally, it involves, you know, meeting someone and talking with them. And I work with a lot of small producers that tend to focus on the fruit and therefore trying to express that in their products and maintain that integrity and, you know, kind of in some ways going along with, you know, terroir in that sense of the word for apples and ciders.
Yeah.
That's really where my personal focus and my, you know, the things that I really enjoy working on. But, you know, I also have worked with some clients that are bigger and maybe what you would consider more commercial ventures. But I think those ciders have a lot of merit as well. And I think that, you know, is a very important aspect of our industry that is growing as much as the craft side of things. So yeah. I do think there's a lot of value in those.
There's something for everyone.
There is. And it's hard for me to fill, you know, what everyone's expectations are. And in some instances, it can work really beautifully. And in some instances, you know, it just either because of geography or needs doesn't work. So, but generally, you know, things are working on from a startup basis,
okay.
Generally.
Okay. Do any of your clients produce cider that is naturally carbonated? The carbonation is from a first or a second fermentation and it's not artificially carbonated?
Yes. I do work with some folks who bottle ferment. And they're, you know, normally served in a champagne-style bottle, some with Belgian beer corks.
Okay.
That's a lot of work.
Yes.
That's a lot of work for cider, and that product demands a higher price point. And so you don't see those as often as you see forced carbonated.
Does anybody, you're calling it forced carbonated. I've never heard that before. Does anybody do a secondary fermentation in the bottle?
Yes. Yeah, and some people are disgorging and some people aren't. I think it depends kind of on preference, but you do see some more like, I guess you would say, the Belgian style, where there is sediment in the bottle.
Okay.
And that's kind of meant as a stylistic to age it on lees.
Yeah, yeah. Do you, in making cider, do you have to pay more attention to sanitation and cleanliness issues with respect to the equipment, more so even than making wine or beer?
You know, I don't really know about beer. I would imagine it's just as rigorous. Sanitation is our biggest defense against problems and spoilage. And so, you know, I think we use generally the same types of cleaners and sanitizers on our processing equipment and bottling equipment. It's pretty rigorous, but, you know, it, depending on the company, sort of their priorities come through. So you see lots of, you know, you see places where, you know, you would eat off the floor and are very sterile. And then you see places which are, you know, just the barn. Sanitation is taken, you know, occurs in the tanks and not outside the equipment.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Now, I never thought to ask Diane this, and I don't remember even looking at the bottle to see if there was something referencing sulfur, like they do on wine.
Right.
Do you use potassium metabisulfite or something to stabilize? Okay.
Yes, we do. We use potassium metabisulfite as our, you know, that's probably our most important tool, along with pH, that we utilize with the ciders to prevent spoilage and just to make sure that the bugs that we want there are there doing the bulk of the work.
Do you ever deal with malolactic or bacterial fermentation that's going to reduce acidity or stabilize or increase complexity as a result of that?
Yes, and I think, you know, if you look at the commercial ciders, generally ML is seen as kind of a nuisance, and it, you know, for products that are quick to market, those are generally, you know, you don't want ML to occur.
Right.
But you do see some in the more farmhouse styles and some of the smaller producers playing around with ML. One of the things about apples is that, you know, the highest acid is malic.
Yep.
And so, you know, if that's 90% of your acid component and you put it through malolactic, it's going to taste pretty flat and flabby and insipid. And so I think it takes a really deft hand to blend that and to manage that and to make to have all those complexities and still maintain some brightness and nerve to the product. So, you know, I think it's a stylistic thing. And often I see with cider, you know, it wants to happen. There is so much of the stuff lying around that you really have to prevent it from occurring in most ciders. So it just depends, I think, on the cider and the style.
Do you have to cold stabilize and precipitate out any, is there even any tartaric acid in cider, in apples?
Well, no, there isn't. And there are, it depends on the components of the juice and whether it's dessert fruit or cider specific fruit. There can be other complexes and reactions that go on in the cider that might need some form of, you know, protein stabilization either for clarity, but generally not. Generally, there's such high tannins that we get good clarity, and because we don't have tartaric acid, we don't have to cold stabilize. But I know some folks that do, and it might be if they use a variation of, say, you know, a blend of acids to ameliorate their juice.
You know, I never thought about tannin content in an apple skin. Mm-hmm. And in talking to Diane, that was kind of an eye-opener to me just because I hadn't thought about it before. But there is substantial tannin in the skin. And I guess that is, it varies even with the cultivar or the clone.
Yes, exactly. It does. And I think that's a really exciting new avenue that I hope that we're going to start to see some research being done on this. I mean, you know, it varies even like with grapes, where the position in the tree and the amount of sunlight that it receives. And, of course, cultivar is probably the biggest determining factor in levels of tannin. And those are spread right throughout the flesh and the seed and the core. But, of course, they're, most of the color compounds are coming from the skin.
So maybe like Virginia Tech or something might end up doing some research because there are a lot of cideries in Virginia.
Yes. We're hoping so. We're so pleased that there is some money being set aside by the wine board, Virginia Wine Board, to help us determine some of these cultural factors in the orchard and how they affect the cider. And, you know, looking at it, there's always going to be, you know, more commercial cider that might have more dessert varieties and more common varieties. But there's always also going to be cider that we're going to make from that's going to be grown specifically to make hard cider. And those are going to be different apples that we're going to select for those qualities that they give in the fermented beverage. And I think the more, you know, we can figure out, there's a big loss maybe for about the last 50 years of research being done on these things. And I think as the industry is growing here in the States, there's becoming a bigger and bigger need for understanding these factors. And so, yes, I hope that more and more we see some research universities and cooperative extensions working with growers and figuring out these complex interactions.
Well, you have sparked the conversation once again. This is so interesting. Jocelyn Kuzelka, we really thank you for joining us this week on Wine and Dine.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn. It was my pleasure.
We will have as many links up as we possibly can. And I forgot to ask her during the interview, so I'll ask her after how she wants me to post how you can get up with her. So surely we'll have something associated with the interview segment description. You're listening to Wine and Dine, and we thank you for doing so.
Thank you so much, Lynn. This has been excellent. Thank you so much for having me on and for indulging my my geeking out a little bit there.
No, that was great. Mostly I talk to people about wine. So
right.
It's interesting to let people know that the conversation is just as interesting and intense with respect to this hard cider production. And, you know,
yeah.
Maybe people might want to learn more. Maybe people might want to even pursue this as something to look into for a college major or et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
So, yes.
I thank you for geeking out. It was perfect.
Well, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to iWine Radio.